Hello and welcome to Open Air, KALW's radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today I'll be joined by actors Noah Weisberg and James Young, who star as Willy Wonka and Grandpa Joe, respectively, in the national tour of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, currently at the Golden Gate Theater. Also stopping by, artistic director of the Carl Bach Society, Paul Flight, to discuss the Society's upcoming concert series, Italian Masters, in 17th century Vienna. Also on this very choral-rich open air from professional vocal ensemble Volti, I'll talk once again with founding artistic director Robert Geary to discuss their 40th anniversary gala and the release of their new CD on May 4th at the Noe Valley Ministry here in San Francisco. Plus, Open Air's regular contributor and critic at large, Peter Robinson, will review ACT's production of Vanity Fair and previews Summer Shakespeare around the Bay Area and beyond, from San Francisco and Marin and Santa Cruz to Cal Shakes in Orinda and the Oregon Shakespeare Festival at Ashland. Stay with us. The California Bach Society in an excerpt from Antonio Bertali's Missa Redemptoris, a work that, though written in the mid-1600s, will just now have its U.S. premiere in concerts this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, respectively in San Francisco, Palo Alto, and Berkeley, under the direction of my guest, Dr. Paul Flight. The California Bach Society, a 30-voice chamber chorus, was recently awarded Best Choral Group and Best Early Music Baroque Ensemble for the 2017-18 season by San Francisco Classical Voice, following a dazzling performance at the Berkeley Early Music Festival in June of 2018. It was founded in 1971, and since his appointment in 2006, artistic director Paul Flight has attracted audiences and critics with his thoughtful and refreshing programming. It's a pleasure to welcome him back to our open-air studios. Dr. Paul Flight is in his 13th season with the California Bach Society. In addition, he is the artistic director of Schola Cantorum San Francisco, a professional chamber choir, and the founding director of Berkeley-based Cora Nova. He's been a visiting professor at the UC Berkeley and at Mills College. And as I said, a pleasure to welcome him back to Open Air. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Great to be here. Thank
you. Great to have such wonderful music. And what's extraordinary to me is that such incredible music is still being discovered.
Yeah, that's right. Antonio Bertali comes very much out of the Venetian polychoral tradition, as exemplified by Gabrielli and later by Monteverdi. In fact, these are the composers that we know best, Gabrielli and Monteverdi, from that time period. But then there are other composers, such as Bertali and the other composer on the program, Valentini, who went to work in different places. So they followed the money and went to Vienna to work in the Habsburg court of the Holy Roman Emperor. They had really excellent church jobs with great forces, and they wrote beautiful music there.
And when did you first hear Bertali? I mean, as a listener.
Well, as a listener, he's mostly known for his instrumental music. There's a famous shakona that people play quite often. And violinists are very fond of Bertali because there are many sonatas with very wonderful violin writing and florid and fiery violin rising. So, but people don't know his sacred music that well. And so I came across this when I was looking for music to program, and I heard a performance at the Utrecht Festival, and I thought this would be something we could really do here, and it would be a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And the good thing about trying to perform something here like this is that the Bay Area has a lot of instrumentalists who play period instruments, and so it makes these kinds of things possible.
Mm. It's wonderful that we have such a strong choral tradition in the Bay Area. It's rather like the dance tradition we have. We have such a plethora of dance companies, all thriving and all have audiences. And like we're going to be hearing from Bob Geary with Volte, also a great following. So Kelbach, 16 years with them, and always discovering new works to bring to light.
Yes, that's right. I try hard. I'd make it a priority to give our audiences music not just by Bach or Handel, but by all of the other myriad of composers that were active in the period from, say, the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries in particular.
And this particular concert focuses on these two composers, Giovanni Valentini and Antonio Bertali. And as I mentioned, the U.S. premiere of Missa Redemptoris.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a gentleman named Bruce Dickey who found the score. He's a cornetist. And he went and dug up the score and performed it at Utrecht. And then once I realized that he had done this, I emailed him and I said, "Wow, Bruce, this would be great. Could we do this here in the U.S.?" And he said, "Sure, I'd be happy to share the music with you." And he did. And so we're able to bring this to the audience for the first time.
Mm-hmm. You're performing, as you do, in three different venues: at St. Mark's Lutheran Church on Friday here in San Francisco, All Saints Episcopal Church in Palo Alto on Saturday, and then a Sunday afternoon 4 p.m. matinee in Berkeley at St. Mark's Episcopal Church. Adapting to these different spaces, are you used to that, or does it take a little bit of fine-tuning once you're back in the space?
It takes a little bit of fine-tuning because they're all very different acoustics. And for me, the big challenge right now is the placement of the brass instruments in order to make the antiphonal quality that you find in so much of this music. And so I've had to move them to different spots in each church to make it work best.
Sure. What else is on your discovery list of works you'd like to bring to the fore?
Well, I have in the long term some ideas about bringing the music of Zelenka to the area. He was a really wonderful composer, a contemporary of Bach, and
I know some of his chamber music. It's quite lovely.
It's really lovely stuff. And so he's written these big sacred pieces. He worked in Dresden at the same time that Bach was working in Leipzig. And so we'll definitely be doing more Zelenka in the coming years, for
uh-huh.
sure.
And plans for next season?
Next season, yeah, we're going to be doing our usual Christmas program, but I usually pick a region or a country. This time it's going to be Christmas in the New World, so we'll be focusing on, you know, North, South, and Central America. It's just be a lot of fun. We're also doing a Bach program, the Bach Magnificat, coming up next year. And let me see, what else are we doing? Oh, and then I'm going to do some 20th century music. The choir has a lovely sound for lots of things, and so we're going to explore some 20th century English music in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm. And tell us about the composition of the choir. How steady of a personnel do you have? How often do people come in to try to be a part of it in terms of audition?
Yeah, we're an amateur choir, and we have a sort of a 7 rehearsal cycle with 3 performances at the end. So it doesn't rehearse every week, which is appealing to some people, actually. And so we're looking, obviously, every choir needs a tenor. or two.
I've heard.
But we're actually looking for sopranos that have a you know, kind of a straight tone, fairly clear clarion straight tone that might join us. That would, of course, be most welcome.
Well, let's point them right. Let's point them right to calbach.org for more information on those the possibility of joining the chorus, and catch them this weekend, of course. Back to this weekend's performances of music of Bertali and Valentini, both sacred and secular on the program.
Yeah, that's right. Valentini was a very fine madrigalist, and he studied with Gabrielli, and one of the conditions of studying with Gabrielli was at the end you would produce a volume of madrigals. And he was a really wonderful madrigalist, and his madrigals have obbligato instruments, which is a little unusual until you get to late Monteverdi. And so we have instrumental combinations playing these madrigals as well. And then sacred motets by Valentini and Bertali, a wonderful setting by Bertali of Psalm 51, Miserere Mei, probably the best setting I've come across, with the single exception of Allegri's setting of the same text. Really wonderful music. And it's been a really great process of discovery putting this program together.
calbach.org, Italian Masters in Vienna, focusing on 17th century Vienna, the music of Giovanni Valentini and Antonio Bertali, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. More information at calbach.org. We're going to go out with more of the Missa Redemptoris. First of all, tell us about where this was recorded, and then we will need to know, for those that are the lay people out there, what the Kyrie is.
Yeah, this is from a performance in Utrecht in Holland, and it is in a concert hall. But the music was intended for a big church and with different spaces for each choir to perform in. It's called antiphonal music. And the Kyrie is the opening movement of the Mass proper. And so the words are Kyrie eleison, Lord have mercy. And that's basically what people might like to know.
Let's have a listen. And thanks so much for your excellent work, Paul.
Thank you.
And we'll see you again soon.
Okay.
From the Missa Redemptoris of Antonio Bertali. Kyrie from the Mass Redemptoris, Missa Redemptoris of Bertali, part of the Cal Bach Society's performances, Friday in San Francisco at St. Mark's Lutheran Church, Saturday in Palo Alto at All Saints Episcopal, Sunday at St. Mark's Episcopal here in Berkeley. More information at calbach.org. More great choral music to come here on this choral-rich edition of Open Air. Good afternoon to you once again. I'm David LaTulipe. We'll be hearing from Bob Geary shortly, and of the 40th anniversary of the Volti Chamber Ensemble. Stay with us.
Who can take a sunrise, sprinkle it with dew, cover it in chocolate and a miracle or two? The Candyman. Oh, the Candyman can. Yes, the Candyman can, 'cause he mixes it with love and makes the world taste good. My name is Willy Wonka. I make chocolate. Quite simply, the greatest invention in the entire history of the world. Whoever could there be who doesn't love the tooth-tickling, tongue-tastical taste of a sweet bar of soft milk? Just
kidding. And who doesn't love the story of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory? We have the Candyman himself in studio today, Noah Weisberg, who plays Willy Wonka in the current touring production of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory at the Golden Gate Theater through May 12th. Noah's a familiar face on television, film, and on stage. On Broadway, he was an Elf, Legally Blonde, South Pacific, and Enron, a show I haven't seen yet. I'm kind of curious about that. We can talk about that, Noah.
Yeah.
He's been with touring companies, including the current Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Big and Grease, included on his television roster, are roles on Modern Family, Law and Order, the inevitable Law and Order, I should say. I think it's on everyone's resume.
That's right.
Mine is on, as well as The Good Wife, many others, and numerous films, including What's Love Got to Do with It? Then came Love and Curse of the Jade Scorpion. Some 175 national TV and radio commercials under his busy belt. Welcome, Mr. Wonka.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by a second actor from the 36-member cast, James Young, who plays the pivotal role of Grandpa Joe, memorably played by Jack Albertson in the 1971
Indeed.
Film that featured Gene Wilder as Wonka. James's 40-year career includes Broadway productions of Crazy for You, My Fair Lady, Me and My Girl, The Tap Dance Kid, A Chorus Line, as well as numerous national tours and regional productions. On TV, on Search Party and One Life to Live, and on film, Ricky and the Flash, Annie, and now on radio, Open Air, among others, I'm sure. James, welcome to you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, what fun is this show on so many fronts. I should have mentioned, actually, in the introductions that you, Noah, actually played Grandpa Joe at the age of 12. So who's giving pointers to whom here? The Broadway veteran to you, or are you offering James tips from your memory as a prepubescent grandpa?
Yeah, James, I don't want to, make you nervous.
That's okay. Go ahead.
But, at 12 years old, I was one of the nation's worst Grandpa Joes. In the heat of puberty, could barely speak, and I think you're doing a much better job.
I did ask him what not to do in the role
right.
several times.
Pee his pants, right?
Yeah,
don't, although, I'm not saying you're old, Josh. We should be careful about that.
Oh, I am.
Well, you mentioned earlier, James, that you guys are having just such a fun time together on stage.
That we are. We do. Noah and I have not worked before this and just seem to really click personalities. The roles are just so compatible, too. Within the story, having worked together, Grandpa having worked at his factory.
Right, I forgot about
right,
that.
Yeah.
We never really learned what happened to Charlie's dad, though, did we?
No.
We sort of assume from the show that he died.
Not drowned in a chocolate river or anything.
Right, exactly.
that we know of. I'm wondering in the story, whether the original Roald Dahl story, if it's mentioned.
In reading, it's been a while, but as I recall, it was kind of nebulous.
I don't remember exactly either, but it makes it sort of... We've updated the story. The cool thing is that you get all the things you love from especially the original movie. I've Got a Golden Ticket, Pure Imagination, Candyman, mm-hmm. the Oompa Loompa song,
right.
plus a whole bunch of twists and turns that you might not expect, and a full score of new songs written by the guys who wrote Hairspray.
Right.
So you're
so it's
a full evening, and it updates it a little bit, too. And here we've got Charlie Bucket's mom, who's this hardworking single mom. Like, what a great sort of updated version, and it just adds that much more heart to the story.
Right.
Roald Dahl was famously critical of the 1971 film with Gene Wilder and Jack Albertson, the wonderful cast, a marvelous film. And he was so it left such a bad taste in his mouth that he refused to give the rights to Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator to be made into a film. I'm wondering what he would have thought of the Johnny Depp 2005 version. Ooh. Or the version now that's on Broadway, and how the rights are granted for adapting that.
That I don't know. As far as getting the rights, I don't know. As far as the Johnny Depp movie, it certainly took a left turn from the original story in the book. There's no doubt about that.
Right. I remember Gene Wilder, before he passed, mentioned his criticism the remake, right. And why it had to be remade in the first place.
Yeah, the other about the book, the elevator, that one I'm not familiar with. Hmm.
The cool thing with our version is that we've got Jack O'Brien directing, who's this literally a legendary three-time right. Tony Award-winning director who on day one said, we're going to do your version. We're not going to copy the Broadway version, as proud as we are. We're actually going to up the sets and make some changes. They wrote a new song for Mrs. TV. Right. And each actor here, we're going to find your version. And we have, for example, we have three young, great young actors who play Charlie, and they rotate night by night. And each of them, they're different. And I think that's the beauty of our production, is that it's true to us, and I think that makes it more relatable to the audience.
And I think it was exciting for them, too. Jack even mentioned when we started rehearsing the fact that they were really lucky as directors to be able to go back and rework a show and fix mistakes they felt that they may have made mm-hmm. in the first production. Mm-hmm. And that was very exciting for them to be able to come back and tweak a little bit here and there, which is a rare thing.
It is interesting that those familiar both with the story and the films, you do get a little bit of everything going on, and then some wonderful new things, including some visually stunning video work that incorporates the set as well as almost like interactive video.
It's all LED lighting, 300,000 something?
Yeah, some crazy number.
Crazy number of little LED lights that they have added to the show, which was not in the original Broadway production. Mm. So that was one of the fixes that they had wanted to put in.
And speaking of one of the new numbers, one of the famous lines is that, you know, at the very start of the film, when Willy Wonka says, we've got so much time and so little to do. Scratch that, reverse it. Yeah. So you got a whole number that's built on scratch that, reverse it.
Yeah, there's a great patter song at the top of Act Two, when I welcome everyone into the factory. And the lyrics are so clever. I mean, these guys, Mark and Scott are great writers. They're really among the best Broadway's ever had. So these new songs hold up so well among the other ones that we've all heard for 40 years.
And I tell you, the way Noah does it, it's impressive.
It really is.
He moves that mouth like nobody ever has.
And I know from moving my mouth, I just did a performance of Walton's Facade last night, and I'm my words, lots of articulation there. Now, this is the first ever national tour of the show, launched last September in Buffalo, New York.
Yes.
And the tour runs through June 14th, 2020.
Yes,
that's incredible. Do you both intend to stay with the show that long, or is it not your call?
It's a little both. We haven't, or at least I have not been asked yet. Depends on what's going to be happening. Some of us want to get back to New York and continue, doing new and exciting things. Personally, I haven't made that decision yet. There's a lot of variables involved, and especially being on my end of the career, going back to New York and starting over again doesn't have the appeal that it has to a youngster.
And you may not want to
upcoming star like Noah here.
You may not want to go out on the town every night in these new cities like the younger set. How about you, Noah? Is this your first national tour, by the way?
This is my first big sort of Class A tour like this. And it's always a tough thing because as artists, we're never fully satisfied. You always want to get the next thing. But we all are so proud and so in love with this show. Mm-hmm. And the group of people we get to work with, we really like. And so it's something you don't want to leave. At the same time, you want to get that next job, right, and use the momentum that you've gained from this. So it'll be a tough call for all of us.
It
and
will.
Whatever our last day is, it'll be emotional.
The message we're bringing to the country with this show, too, it's just, it's a hard thing to leave.
And it's perfectly timed.
It really is. The reactions from the audiences are just phenomenal.
It's a pleasure to see. It really is. Now, Roald Dahl was known for inventing words, new words. Oompa Loompa is a new word. Snozberries, I don't know. Is snozberries mentioned in this
production? No, snozberries aren't. No.
Nor are there pernicious knids, are they?
No.
The Bane of the Oompa Loompas.
No, you don't do
no,
that
I don't.
You do the Schnozwangler.
Yeah, I have a weird thing that, like, if you ask me to say one line right now, I don't know any of my lines outside
context.
The show.
Well,
I was thinking that exact same thing, because I actually do say three of those words outside of the play right now. I'm the same thing, blanking on.
Yeah. But there's that fun language that is, it, like you said, you know, moving your mouth. It just feels good as a performer to say these words every night.
Schnoztastic. That's what
Schnoztastic.
Schnoztastic is one of my favorites.
Yeah.
It's almost like a Jimmy Durante word.
Yeah.
Cutting. Hey, butting-a-doo. Roald Dahl was also a big lover of chocolate, and he admitted that he ate too much of it. How about you guys? Are you...
I have to admit that nightly, when the chocolate bar comes out of the television set, I have to take a little bit of a taste.
It's not a terrible part of the game.
No, it's not.
No.
You keeping track of the number of productions that you've been in terms of candy wrappers or notches on your belt?
No, but actually what they do, the stage manager nightly lets us know what number show we are doing. I think we are up to 240
or
something or other. Yeah, 240 is what we're now at.
Nice. Well, I wish you at least 240 more if you're up for it.
Thank you.
I only have one thing to say about the chocolate is I wish they had put Ghirardelli in there instead.
Oh, well, you know. Well, that's where you got to make up, you know, get in with the props people, James.
Right, exactly.
Now, as much fun as you guys are having, how much fun is watching the Oompa Loompas at work?
Oh. Sadly for us, they're the stars of the show.
Yeah.
tell us how incredibly I don't want to spoiler alert. This is how the Oompa Loompas are done. It's just really incredibly.
So the cool
creative.
Thing is, yeah, we'll leave the sort of magic of it to you guys when you come see the show. But I will just say that it gets a huge round of applause every night, and you think, all right, how are they going to do this? And I can't imagine, just as a fan of the theater, not even a guy in the show, as a fan of theater. I think they could not have done a more creative version of this. Uh-huh. We have an amazing creative team who created them, and part of them, I think, were built by Jim Henson's company.
Yeah.
I mean, they are like, it is a real sight.
And then at the end of the show, actually in the finale, the curtain call, the Oompa Loompas do a nod to 42nd Street.
Yeah, they do a big tap number at the end.
A big tap number that is, really... yeah, I don't know if you remember from 42nd Street, the curtain goes up about 2 feet.
Right.
So that all you see, well, it's, shall we say, similar.
Yes. Get her to shnsf.com for more information. We're going to go out with the classic Gene Wilder singing Pure Imagination. But before we do, cast your vote. The original book, the 1971 film, the 2005 film, or the Broadway production? Mm-hmm. James.
That's a tough one. They're all so different, have their own things. I'm gonna say us. What can I say?
Noah, you taking one for the team as well?
I'm going to say I got to watch the show. I got to sit out once and watch it. And so for that reason alone, watching my friends up there, I'm going to say our version.
Pure Imagination. Thank you, Noah Weisberg and James Young, for coming in and sharing your thoughts about the show. And I wish you a fantastic tour of it.
Thanks for having us.
I appreciate it.
Hold your breath. Make a wish. Count to three.
Come with me, and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look, and you'll see into your imagination. We'll begin with a spin, traveling in the world of my creation. What we'll see will defy explanation. If you want to view paradise, simply look around and view it. Anything you want to do it, want to change the world, there's nothing to it.
Through May 12th, the incredibly creative production of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory at the Golden Gate Theater, shnsf.com. www.vinicia.com for more information. That's an excerpt from Ivory Depths by Tonya Coe, an excerpt from the movement called Monday. And it's from the new release by Volti called The Color of There, Seen from Here, celebrating 40 years of Volti with this new CD release. And who better to talk about it than the man that was there when it all started? Robert Geary. Bob, welcome back to Open Air.
Hi, David. Thanks very much for having me back. I love the chance to come and chat about these things.
Oh, it's beautiful music. Tell us a little bit about Tonya Coe, then we can talk about more.
Yeah,
about
we
the CD.
Found Tonya Coe as when she was an applicant. She's a young woman from Hawaii, finishing her doctoral studies. I think she's all done with those now, actually, and is teaching. But we found her when she applied to be for our Choral Arts Laboratory program, which was a competitive situation for composers under the age of 35, and we received several dozen applications each year and selected from that and found her to be particularly exciting, kind of a unique voice. She grew up in a choral situation in Hawaii. There is a good children's choir there, and she got her start there.
Mm-hmm. And so the title, From Ivory Depths, what is that she's
trying to
evoke
Virginia Woolf.
There?
It might be helpful just for the listeners to hear, you know, it's excerpts from Virginia Woolf poetry, and that particular part was white and distant, absorbed in itself, endlessly the sky covers and uncovers, moves and remains. Mm. And Tonya really just kind of explores the idea of breaking words down into their elements and shaping and reshaping and morphing from one vocalism to another, to a word, away from a word. Find that to be quite a unique and compelling approach and reflective of this poetry that is restless and moving always.
Mm-hmm. There are two movements that are on the CD, at least, of Tonya Coe's From Ivory Depths. Is there more that she's working on?
That's a complete work, as far as I know. I'm happy to say that because we have enjoyed her work so much, we've invited her to write something for us for next season also. So this is one of the composers, as we move through the years, we find people who we think have a special voice and ask them to write for us multiple times.
One of those is very well represented on this CD, Mark Wingis, who's been Volti's resident composer since 1990. Goodness.
Yeah, he gets a lot of credit for breaking me in, kind of. Mark has a particular chromatic language and very rhythmic, sometimes very interesting, complex rhythmic language. And back in the 90s, when I hadn't been conducting for that long, I stumbled into working on the first piece we did with him called A Spool of Dream, and that was kind of an eye-opener for me. It made me learn a whole bunch more about how to conduct and how to analyze a piece, which is a lifelong process.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
But anyway, yeah, Mark's written for us. I think we've premiered 15 works of his over the years.
And speaking of setting great poetry, All Night is the title of his work, his contribution to the CD, setting the poetry of Gustav Sobin, a composer that I'm, or a poet I'm not familiar with.
Yeah, well, I'm not really, except for this piece, but Mark, as are many composers, digs deep into poetry and finds some amazing poetry sources for his music, stuff that can go back to the 7th century Chinese dynasties or to the beat poets or to more contemporary poets, as Sobin falls into that latter group.
Mm-hmm. And writers, speaking of writers, local writers that have been inspired by composers, Rebecca Solnit is responsible for inspiring a work by a Lithuanian-born composer. You're going to say her name.
Yeah. Žibuoklė Martinaitytė.
Okay.
She doesn't know it, but I nicknamed her Gigi, so I'm not sure she would appreciate that. But anyway, she lives in New York and is a naturalized U.S. citizen now, with ties to the Bay Area. She met her husband while she was in the Bay Area. And again, she sent us a score. It's another way we come upon music. We get unsolicited scores from composers, and we have a review process that we go through. And this piece was one that we just thought was, again, a unique piece. It's a very slow-to-unfold, beautiful, sonically beautiful exploitation of individual what we're doing more and more of is we have an ensemble right now of anywhere from 16 to 20 singers, but we often do music where each person has their own part.
Hmm.
So it requires that level of artistry.
Wow.
And this was the case for Žibuoklė's piece as well.
And in spite of it being inspired by Rebecca Solnit's book, A Field Guide to Getting Lost, it's textless.
Yeah, it's textless. Žibuoklė has very good English, but it's not a native tongue for her. And I think as she explores her own relationship to language and how language and music interact, in this particular case, she felt like moving away from language and into an impression, and using the voice differently was what she wanted to do.
Also on the CD, composer I'm not familiar with, Robin Estrada. What inspired you to include Robin's piece?
We've commissioned Robin a couple of times. Robin is Philippine-born. And she got her doctorate at Cal in Berkeley. So she's been working in the Bay Area. She's a fine vocalist herself. And we previously recorded a piece called Pag Hahandog. Robin fuses very, very skillfully elements of Asian music, South Asian music. In the case of both pieces Volti's commissioned, there are gamelan elements built into the vocal parts. But In Chele and Arant, actually, basically, Robin is seeking a better world, as composers often are in a more direct way, and has set the idea of treating others as you would treat yourself into the poetry. So it's rhythmic and compelling, and it blends. You can hear sort of elements of ancient Western chant, like maybe references to, not quotes, Gregorian style mixed in with these gamelan sounds. So it makes for quite a nice piece.
Talking with Robert Geary, the founding director of Volti, celebrating its 40th season with a special CD release party and concert. Let's talk about that, Bob. 40 years. Who'd have thunk it?
Yeah. I have to say, you know, it's probably true of anybody that founds anything, but, you know, I sort of get the credit. But in fact, there were a whole group of us that had been singing together in Byron McGillivray's chorale out at San Francisco State, which was a semi-pro organization. And a bunch of us got together after we had had enough of that experience. And one particular singer who was still singing professionally in this area, Ed Betts, said, "Why don't you start a group?" And I had advanced degree in choral conducting and was beginning to find my way at that point. So a whole bunch of us hatched that that idea, and over time, as some of those folks went off and were helping start Chanticleer or were teaching here and there, and a lot of them are still active in various ways, I was the last one standing, so I'm the founder.
Still are standing and surfing, I understand.
Yeah. Gotta stay healthy.
Good for you. And which brings us to the 40th anniversary party on the 4th of May, Saturday, May 4th. An anniversary gala concert and CD release party?
Yeah, there's a lot to make that evening fun. We will do a concert. We'll have six composers represented on that concert, several of whom are on the new CD, including Robin and Tonia.
Also, and Gordon Getty.
Mark Wingus, Gordon Getty. Forrest Pierce, whose Gratitude Sutra we'll hear a little bit of in a minute or two. We'll all be there, so they'll be signing CDs, and people who come to the concert will get a complimentary copy of the new CD and an opportunity to bid on all kinds of wonderful options.
Silent auction, of course.
And lots of good food and drink.
That gets underway at 6:30. The concert that begins at 7:30 will have welcoming remarks from our own Sarah Cahill.
Yeah,
we've had
Sarah's
a long association with Sarah as well.
Us, yeah.
Yeah. Super. And then dessert afterwards, of course. Meet the composers and singers of Volti. Shake their hands. Congratulate them on 40 years of singing incredible music here in the Bay Area. The concert on the 4th of May and the party at Noe Valley Ministry, 1021 Sanchez Street in San Francisco. You know, I've been here since 2002. I've yet to get to Noe Valley Ministry, so I'm going to make a point of
it. Oh, so you were here before they renovated it, so now you get to hear it even better. It's a very good performance space.
Good to
so,
know.
Yes,
right.
You are on our guest list, David.
All right, great to know. And find out more at
VoltiSF.org.
VoltiSF.org. We're going to hear one more piece from The Color of There, seen from here, to go out with our talk with Bob Gary. Tell us a little bit about Forrest Pierce and about his work, Gratitude Sutra.
Yeah, Forrest Pierce is on a university faculty in Kansas, but he's quite an award-winning composer. And we stumbled into this project in a wonderful way. The Barlow Foundation asked us if we would join the BBC Singers and the Lithuanian Radio Choir to be the first three to perform a work by the winner of the Barlow Endowment's award. And Forrest Pierce was the recipient of that award. And we actually gave the world premiere, and it was later performed in, I said Lithuania, I think it was the Latvian radio choir, excuse me. But it was later performed in Latvia and in England by BBC singers. So we were really happy to be included with that stellar group of other choirs. And Forrest, being an American, leaned towards Gary Snyder's kind of an homage to Mother Earth, invoking various elements with thanks and praise. Yeah, and we'll hear the last couple of minutes of that. And I had that open. Yeah, we're going to show our gratitude to the great sky, who holds billions of stars, and then finally to Grandfather Space. So the last two parts of the Gratitude Sutras by Forrest Pierce and the poetry of Gary Snyder.
And let me be the first to wish you 40 more, Bob.
Thank you very much, David.
Thanks for coming
in. I'm looking
forward
to all 40 of them.
Ooh.
The amazing sound of Volte San Francisco under the direction of Bob Geary. More information on their concerts at voltesf.org. Well, rounding out this hour of Open Air, I'm pleased to welcome back my regular contributor and critic at large, Peter Robinson. From the vocal, we go to the literary. We'll be talking about the adaptation of William Makepeace Thackeray's classic 19th century novel, Vanity Fair, at ACT, and a little bit of Shakespeare for you. Welcome back, Peter.
Good, David. Yeah, good to be here. And this version of Vanity Fair, this production, is really a very upbeat production. I would highly recommend it. You don't have to be a novel reader. A novel itself is some 600 to 700 pages, and the adaptation, which is done really well, has got it down to roughly 2.5 hours with an interval. So when I say it's upbeat, what they've done, and Kate Hamill in the whole rewriting of this, has given us a kind of vaudeville, late 19th century kind of beat to it. And at the centre of the stage is Dan Hyatt, a familiar face to many ACT goers. He plays the role of the manager, but he's also like an MC. He combines storytelling, he combines music with song, and he also provides commentary. So he essentially is the centre of the action, almost like a ringmaster in the circus. And, of course, the other key character is the very mysterious, enigmatic, and let's use the word wicked, Becky Sharp. She holds the stage throughout, and Rebecca Brockman, who plays the role of Becky Sharp, I think raises all those questions not only about contemporary feminism, but where the status of women was in 1848. And I think it's worth saying a word about 1848, which is the year that Thackeray wrote the book. He reflects back about 30 years, so it's actually set in the Napoleonic War period. But 1848 was a critical time in European history. There were revolutions happening across Europe. So it's a time of turmoil, and the status of feminism, the status of class, the status of politics, the status of women begins to emerge at the forefront. So we have two very different types of women at this story. We've got the Becky character, but we also have a good friend, Amelia, played by Maribel Martinez, and she is the good. Let's say Becky is the evil. They're both, in their own ways, mischievous, but I think what you take from this play is how a story from the mid-19th century has a great deal of relevance to us in 2019. Now, I said it's an upbeat production. One of my favourite numbers opens Act Two, and in fact, it's a song which is written in the 1890s. It's called Hold Your Hand Out, You Naughty Boy. And it's a good example of bringing music hall to get the audience's attention as we go through the love matches, the breaking up of love matches, the meaning of money. It is, of course, like the rest of the show, a great piece of satire. So if you're looking for something different, don't be misled by thinking you're going to see a Dickensian, stuffy, Victorian moral play. What you're going to find is this very lively, musical, come wit, come satire, adaptation, which I think really speaks to today as it did at the time when Thackeray wrote the book.
The Wall Street Journal named Kate Hamill, the playwright, the 2017 Playwright of the Year, and wrote that this is a masterpiece of creative compression that is at once arrestingly original and faithful to its source material. So,
and she indeed has a long history of being able to adapt earlier novels from Jane Austen, and of course with this particular version. The sets, interesting, they don't over-dominate the story. And the costumes, again, when you arrive before the play, they do have actors in Regency-style costumes, so you're beginning to get into the feel of the thing as you wander around. I also, I think I enjoyed the interaction. This is a play where many actors play many parts, and you've got to keep your eyes open, your ears up, to make sure you know who's who in the zoo here. And I just want to give a shout-out to Anthony Michael Lopez, who plays Dobbin, who is the kind of lover, the second major male character, and Vincent Randazzo, who again plays everything from female to male characters, including King George. So you've got really a lot of action on stage. You've got music, you've got dancing, you've got satire, you've got wit, you've got conversation. And I think what you also have is history, because this does take us through a period of time, the Napoleonic Wars, when the military were held up. It's a anti-heroic play to that extent. It's an anti-class play. And it also questions the meaning of money. What do we do to get ahead in life? Because Becky Sharp starts in poverty, in penury. She earns her way up. She has dubious morality. On the other hand, we find ourselves sitting there rooting for her. So I highly recommend a trip down to ACT. It's a very colourful costume drama, full of jokes, full of wit, and some good songs. And that's Vanity Fair running open last night.
ACT's Geary Theatre through May 12th, act-sf.org for more information. Let's turn to Shakespeare.
Oh, God, I hate Shakespeare. That's right, I said it.
No.
I do, I hate Shakespeare.
Why?
I just don't get it, how a mediocre actor from a measly little town is suddenly the brightest jewel in England's royal crown. Oh, God, I hate Shakespeare. His plays are wordy, but oh, no, the great Shakespeare. That little turd, he has no sense about the audience. He makes them feel so dumb. The bastard doesn't care that my poor ass is getting numb.
How can you say that? How can you say that?
It's easy, I can say it, cause it's absolutely true.
Don't be a penis, the man is a genius.
His genius is he's fooling all of you.
I'm something rotten. God, I hate Shakespeare. In this room, I think we all love Shakespeare, wouldn't you say, Peter?
Yes, I would say it's, again, time to literally brush up your Shakespeare. And I think that lively number, which has got a lot of double entendres, I keep on thinking what word could rhyme with genius, but they found something to do it in this particular
piece.
They
did.
So across the bay and up to Ashland this time of year, I think there's more Shakespearean choices than you may even find in the Bard's hometown of Stratford-on-Avon. So we're going to be moving back and forth from different parts of the bay area because there are some repetition of plays. But we're going to kick off at Cowshakes, which is in Arinda, and it opens with Midsummer's Night Dream on May the 22nd, running through June. And it also finishes with Macbeth. So you have a good combination of both comedy and tragedy. And let me give you a couple of tips if you're going out to Cowshakes. They do have a shuttle, so you can take the train. You can certainly bring a picnic.
Shuttle from Bart, you should.
Bart, okay. You can certainly bring a picnic, and I always recommend arriving early to capture Philippa Kelly, the dramaturge, as she gives an excellent preview, a little background, some deeper understanding of what you're about to see.
Philippa is a wonderful guest. We hope to have her on to talk about Cowshakes.
Yes, she'll be in later in the year just to talk about that, and she is a Shakespearean tragic expert, so Macbeth, closing off the season, falls into that category. Macbeth, of course, is the Scottish play. Opens with the three witches on the heath. When shall we three meet again? When the hurly-burly's done. And suddenly you're into the realm of political assassination. You're into the realm of ambition with Lady Macbeth. And it is, of course, a drama that will stay with you as there are ghosts and haunting experiences. So that's what Cowshakes will be finishing with, and they do open with that wonderful comedy, Midsummer's Night Dream. Now, I'm going to stay with Macbeth for a second because it's also playing up in Ashland. Ashland is the home of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. They too have a fairly extensive range, depending on what time of year you go. They are doing As You Like It as a contrast again. And I want to say a couple of words about Ashland. It's about a six-hour drive, interesting drive, up to the borders of Oregon. And as a town, there's plenty to do when you're not at the theatre. I always enjoy the whitewater rafting on the Rogue. You've got some spills and thrills on Class 4 Rapids. And there are a number of companies. If you're a biker or a rider, they'll take your bikes in the van up to the top of Mount Ashland. And it's a beautiful freewheel drive, no pedaling needed, and a great overview of the city. Now, there's three major theatres at Ashland where you can see different pieces of Shakespeare. And All's Well That Ends Well, As You Like It, are all running the same week that Macbeth is. So again, you've got plenty of choices and also contemporary drama going on. Coming back to home here in the Bay Area, out at the College of Dominican College out in San Rafael, there is the Marin Shakespeare Company. They're producing Midsummer's Night Dream. It's again with Leslie Currier, who was the great starter of that, and that brings their summer program to an end in September. And they are opening with Measure for Measure. That starts on June the 29th. So again, you've got a good range of tragedy. Measure for Measure is one of the great problem plays about justice, and that's produced by Robert Currier, Leslie's husband. Again, it's a outdoor theatre where you can enjoy a pre-picnic. Now, if you want to travel south, Shakespeare at Santa Cruz is now back in action. It's in the Centre Park, that's the Audrey Stanley Park, and they open with Comedy of Errors, and they finish with one of Shakespeare's last stage, a fairy tale romance, The Winter's Tale. So really, you've got comedy, you've got history, you've got philosophy, you've got tragedy, and this year, you've even got music. Shakespeare in the Park is giving a musical version of As You Like It. So if you're a Shakespeare buff, not only time to brush up your Shakespeare, plenty of time to see it on stage. And I always recommend, if you want to pre-read the play, the Arden edition of Shakespeare. It's a good one to have handy, excellent notes, and certainly a way of knowing what the best lines are before you hear them spoken by the actors.
We'll have links to all of these Shakespeare offerings at our website, www.kalw.org. Thank you, Peter. Hope to see you among the audiences at some of these events.
Yeah, looks forward to an exciting summer. Good to be here, David. Thank you.
Should also mention that San Francisco Shakespeare Festival is having its 7th annual gala, All the World's a Stage, this coming Saturday, beginning at 6 p.m. You can learn more at sfshakes.org. Again, the link is at our website, klw.org, open air on that page. It's going to be up at the Marines Memorial Club on Sutter Street here in San Francisco, Saturday night, SF Shakes. Good luck to them and to all of our merry friends of the Bard in the Bay Area and beyond. That's Open Air for this week. I'm David Latulipe. Thanks so much for listening. A reminder that the shows are archived at kalw.org. Neil Swinkles produces the show, and if you've got a show suggestion, by all means, send me an email, david@kalw.org.